Blog Talk Radio.
It's been a month of August already, August 2020. Summer is on the move. It's not slowing down. We've been on a summer schedule for the past couple of months. As it did, we did 6 shows per month as we did the rest of the year. We'll come back with the show back in September, but currently we're doing two. We're skipping a week, and we're coming on for a week. Well, thank you for giving us a listen and hanging out with us. You know, during summertime, there's many other things you could be doing, like rolling, some of that, but you decide to, you know, give us some of our networks that we're on, Spotify, Google, Amazon, iHeartRadio, just to name a few. Thank you. Appreciate you taking time out to listen. When I say listen to three gentlemen that get together, for the most part, that share dialogue on love, relationships, and different factors of life. And we're always shooting for an honest self-evaluation. We kind of always want to start there. And then basically, we take pride in not shying away from things that need to be said. When I talk about three gentlemen, I'm speaking of myself, Mark Elliott, Mr. DeMaurice, and Mr. Charles. When we all come together, we are black men that talk for the most part. Black men talk. When you think about it, we are three men, and then we are black, so that makes it up black men talk. Mr. DeMaurice, Mr. Charles, let me get you two gentlemen in before we get things kicked off this time around. How y'all two gentlemen doing?
I'm good, man. I'm Samoan, bro. I didn't give you the... I'm doing great, man. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How about yourself, Mr. Charles?
I'm good, man. I'm really frustrated that you're not talking about my Haitian background, man. I'm going to represent my people from Haiti. You're struggling right now, but we're on the come up. We're on the come up, bro.
Good to see you too, John. Because we got to do. Tonight we're going to do something that we've been doing this week. We have never done before. I'm going to speak on that in a little bit. I was listening to last week, and it was by a young cat, Jameson Nelson, the guy that performed the song. And this was shifting the atmosphere. But might have been my second time hearing this song, but started listening to the lyrics, and as he started to get towards the end, when he started speaking other than singing, saying some things about how you kind of really can shift the atmosphere, I kind of started to notice that, in a sense, it was something that he was saying that was kind of moving. So I wanted to kind of basically use that as a backdrop for us to what we're going to do for this evening. So you might hear me say that a couple of times, you know, shifting the atmosphere. But mainly when I say that, in a sense, it's basically, in a way, doing some things different or looking at some things different than we kind of usually do, in a sense. And as we progress on the show, I kind of make a little more sense. But this evening's show, in a sense, I want us to take a look at the association between black men and drugs. Because I came across a news article a couple of weeks ago where these gentlemen in New York, Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and I think it was another part, Florence, South Carolina, they were running a drug ring. There's about 50 of them. And there was an operation that went on to basically shut down the drug ring. The operation was called New Optic. So they basically, the feds set out to basically shut down the drug ring. And it's a total of 50 cats that came out of this that got arrested. And I think there might be four more that they're looking for. But out of the 50, they basically captured all of them except for the four. And they were showing the faces in the article. And it was dropping the names and seeing one brother after another, one brother after another, one brother after another. And I'm like, okay, you know, and I know this is basically a small dent when you think worldwide what's going on, but it made me start to think, when you look at our population of black men, it's not that many of us when you really think about it. And numbers, you may look at the numbers, you go, okay, yeah. But when you think about how many of us are basically lifestyle, we know where that lifestyle leads you to for the most part. It's not going to take anywhere, any place glamorous. It kind of leads you to one or two places. And I started thinking about all the manpower that our community is losing when stuff like this happens, when they step into that lifestyle. Now, sometimes we can't identify totally why they choose to do certain things as sell drugs. But I wanted to kind of change our focus in a sense, because a lot of times for the ones that us that are not selling drugs, just stand back and look at them, we say certain things, and we just kind of keep it moving for the most part, and we leave it there. Here's where I say shift the atmosphere in a sense. I no longer want to kind of look at them, and I've been guilty of this myself, but I don't want to no longer look at them in a sense and kind of basically write them off as basically damaging our community, doing something that doesn't benefit us. I want to shift the atmosphere in a sense to basically pray for them that they will turn away from that and that will God find a way to basically use them to do something different with their skills and move away from that. And that's something that, in my mind, I could be honest and say I've never kind of thought about doing before. I would look at it, maybe get frustrated and, you know, stuff of that nature. But after hearing this song, I was like, Mark, you have to start to look at this a little differently. And when that came to me, I said, you know what, let's do something that we haven't done on this show. You know, let's play individually. And I wanted to basically set up to where we take time out, a matter of, I thought 30 seconds would actually be a good way to do it. Take 30 seconds and just basically do an individual personal prayer. You don't have to be saying anything, because to me, prayer is personal anyway. But take 30 seconds, and we kick back, and we basically pray for the men that are out there doing certain things that, you know, from time to time we have condoned and overlooked. We've made excuses for why they're doing it. But here again, we know where that lifestyle lives. And basically us, we could have the opportunities, and I know we have talked about it in length on this show, but we could have basically been down that path as well. And probably the reasons why we haven't been, because we have men in our lives to basically let us know that's not the path we want to take and explain to us why not to take that path. And some of these cats didn't have, were fortunate to have that. So they're basically going on their own, and they're thinking that for whatever reason, this is the path they should take. So that, with that in mind, I want to basically take out 30 seconds, Mr. Charles, Mr. D. Maurice, and myself, go quiet, go silent, and let's pray for these gentlemen. 30 seconds start now. Prison is a place of rehabilitation, and that's a word that kind of gets lost when we think of prison in a sense, but the action of restoring life after imprisonment. And there's some cats that have done this, but I think as a whole, the majority hasn't. So I'm going to come to you first, Mr. D. Maurice, if you can find someone that basically has taken that path to where they started out doing selling drugs of that nature, they went to, got caught, went to prison, and they came out and basically turned their life in a different direction and went in different pastures. If you know of someone, and I'll come to you next, Mr. Charles, well, I want to speak of that, because a lot of times we believe when we look at these gentlemen that they're doing it, that this, that's just the rest of their life. They're not going to basically be able to turn things around, but there are some good stories out there. So I'll come to you first with this, Mr. Demarese. If you know someone, please share the story, sir.
Yeah, and you know him too. It's my boy, Doc, and we grew up together, man. We this guy, we're still great friends to this day. When I tell you that, you know, when you talk about a buddy that, you know, from fat crayons to, you know, being men, that, you know, this is the guy. This is the guy in the same neighborhood. I'm very close to his mom. His mom is like my mom. We lived a block away from each other. We always hung out together. We had a number of friends, but he got into the lifestyle, man, and after we talked, you know, after he got out a few years ago, he started sharing a lot of things that I didn't really understand and really didn't know about, even though we were really close in the relationship with his mother. And I talked to her about, you know, how he grew up and things of that sort. And she was sharing things that, you know, some things she regretted doing and that she didn't know what was going on. And, you know, he got caught up in the lifestyle, and I think he went to jail. It was like 25 to life for murder. And I think in Connecticut at the time, they didn't have I think a law that if you're protecting yourself that you can kind of get off. I forget what you kind of call it, but they didn't have that rule where if you were somebody attacked you and it turned out fatal, and you were protecting yourself, that you didn't get that loophole. And so I remember going to see him when I went to Connecticut one year and going to visit him in prison. And we hadn't talked in a while before then. We had kind of separated our ways because of where he was going, I was going in a complete opposite direction. And, you know, we decided, you know, just to kind of part ways for a while. But the funny thing, I was there when I was going there to see him. I got kind of a special pass to go there and see him because he had talked me up so much to the people at the prison that they were like, you know, we got to let you come in here. It seems like this is going to be a good visit for him. And he was just telling me that people wouldn't come and see him. People stopped writing him. People wouldn't send things to put on his book so he can get, you know, certain, like, things that he needed in prison. You know, I tried to do what I could. I'm not saying that I always sent stuff, but I tried to do what I could. To see him now, man, and he's not, I think a success story is waking up in the morning and being able to do what you want to do. And he found religion in prison. He kind of stays in the church. He still does rapping and all that other stuff. He's still in the music and all that stuff and trying to have a positive life. And he has some more kids that, at the ripe old age of 54, 55, he's still being Jacob and, you know, Abraham and having and fathering many children. But just to see him and talk to him, and we're both big into martial arts, and I talked to him a lot about that, and his mind is so sharp, and I always wondered, and he's so smart and intelligent, I always wondered if he went a different way, where would he be right now? But I think he's realizing that now, and when we talk to each other, man, we spend hours on the phone just talking about, you know, different things, life and all that other stuff, and laughing, and I'm glad that he's out. I plan on, hopefully, when this thing, the dust settles from this thing, I want to bring him to Chicago just to visit and just to hang out, man. I want all my boys to come to Chicago or meet them wherever they are, man, just to spend time, man, because I'm missing the faces. I'm missing the camaraderie. I'm missing not sitting with my boys and having a drink and laughing and talking and reminiscing with our lifestyles and what's happening now. But he's one of the stories that I think of a lot because he's closest to me. and you were right when you were saying earlier about but for the grace of God go I, because, you know, the, how close we were, I could have been in the same jail cell with him. That's how close we were. That's how we got down. We had each other's back. But when I was in college, I his mom told me to check up on him, and I went to where he was at, and I didn't see a future for him. And I'm like, I begged him, man, come to school with me, or just come and live in the dorm until we can get you situated to come to school. And that's not what he wanted. That's not what he wanted at the time. And we discussed it over the years. I remember saying, man, I should have went with you. I should have just left and went with you. But there were a lot of things that were behind it that as we grow older and realize, you know, the impact of some of the psychological things that happened to us when we were kids, that determine sometimes our path sometimes. So I didn't understand it, but I understand it now. He's come to grips with it. And, you know, you hate to say that, you know, you have to take a fall like that to kind of figure out where you're going and who you are. But I think it really helped him in figuring out, you know, where he was going and who he is. And that's my boy. He's always going to be my boy. And that's my story. That's my story.
Appreciate you sharing, man. That's why, you know, we did the prayer this evening. And we're going to do more of that, because that's how we're going to start to shift the atmosphere. Because there's so many stories out there just like him, man, that for whatever reason, what he came up around, what was there, allowed him to make the transition to doing that so easy and may not have seen anything else to do. And I remember we talked about this several times in the show in the past, and I remember you, Mr. Charles, said that a lot of us as young men don't see our lives progressing beyond 20s and 30s. They just basically think that, you know, I'm in my mid-20s or mid-30s, and they don't see life progressing beyond that. And that is so shallow and so scary and so deep to think that that's all you have. So some of them, people that think that, where they live reckless because they want to grab what they can't grab now because they don't think of the longevity. And to me, when I hear that, it always kind of resonates in my head, like, how can that be? How could not anyone desire not to have a long journey in this gift of life? Mr. Charles, if you have a story you want to share, my brother, please do. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I was thinking about who or one other person, but hell, so there's a combination of folks. So anyway, I'm gonna just say that I'm aware of an individual. I know somebody that went to prison for drugs, and they got out, and it was really bizarre because when you think about this particular person, we went to school together. We weren't so close. Some other people that I know that I was probably closer with went to prison and got out, or they were doing one bid, and then they ended up shortly thereafter doing another bid. I have a friend I knew from growing up and in the neighborhood and skating and stuff like that. He was a kingpin. And I think he was under governmental protection. And so once everything ended for him, he was playing it low key. Come to find out, not too much long, probably maybe another 10 or maybe a few years later, another case came up, and they got him for being a kingpin again. Just changed the drug of choice that he was caught up in. So that was pretty sad. But this particular person that I went to school with, what was really different about this to me was this guy was a pretty, for his age and his class, he's a pretty solid athlete. And you saw he had the potential to go to college and do well, definitely played Division I basketball. And he seemed more of a kind of cool guy. The guys that I knew back then, some of them were, you kind of tell he was a little bit more reckless than somebody that really was a tough guy. And he had that in him to maybe choose that life or be a little bit more reckless, right? This particular guy didn't seem that way. And when I heard that he got caught up the way that he did, it surprised me because I was like, I'm not sure if he's built for this, right? I just didn't think, you know, because when I thought about people like that, I said, oh, man, that's a bad thing for anybody. But he didn't seem to be built for that life, if you will. But, yeah, he did that, and he did his time. And came out, and one thing about it was I just heard about different things about him, but apparently I think he found, religion, or he found the Lord, and ran into a beautiful woman that helped him change his life. And he married her and just seemed to become a different person. And the stuff that he's doing now, it seems as if his rehabilitation, if you want to call it that, the way he's living his life is a lot different now. And I'm happy for him because he's in a position to do some things that he likes to do. He's still connected with sports. And I'm not sure back in the day when we were coming up, if he had went to prison and the times were that way that they are were back then, I'm not sure if he would have got a second chance to do some things he's doing right now. And I think he's on social media. He has like a sports talk show. And people relate to him, and I'm happy for him because a lot of people are being shunned because of their background. But, so I was surprised by that. And it appears as if he's doing well, and I'm happy for him for that because normally that's not the case. I know a few other cases where people went to prison, even in my family, and they've been out selling drugs for somebody else, took a fall. They've been out for maybe, 5 years, and they still have not readjusted well. Their life it's not great because I think they don't know what else they can do. They don't have a plan. They don't see themselves their way. And unfortunately, when you lose people that are dear to you, particularly your parents, grandmother, somebody that really close to you, they are probably, you feel like those are the only people that really love you and care about you. The other people tolerate you, but they don't really check on you all that way. And when you lose those people, these particular individuals, certain ones, they're lost because their main supporter is gone. Now they don't know what the hell to do. Do I just do something stupid and go back to being in prison? But what do? I just exist now, which is really scary to me. But then it's really hard because they don't know what to do and where to go. What's their next step? And they keep repeating the same thing over and over, like the encouragement and things. So, yeah, it can be very tough for certain people. And I know people will say, well, they did it to themselves. I get all that too, but you got to understand the situation. Because once you really understand it, the really sad thing is oftentimes certain men don't feel they have any type of alternatives in life. And, again, they just exist.
I hear that, Mr. Charles, and that's why, at least for me and hope for others, that we start to shift the atmosphere because we can no longer write these brothers off like, okay, they're doing that, that's what they choose to do, and, let them go because they're still our brothers. They still are. We are who we are. We make up the race of black men, and we all don't do what we should be doing at the appropriate time, but that doesn't mean you're still not part of our community. And we have to be able to welcome them back in as God changed their lives and bring them back to where he wants them to be. We have to be able to welcome them back in. Remember about a year ago, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, I saluted this brother. I can't remember his name, but there was a brother in North Carolina that had a trucking company, and he was only hiring and training brothers that came out of prison to drive trucks. Mm-hmm. That's all he was hiring. He was hiring no one else, man. So if you came out, it was about, you really wanted a fresh start, he was giving you an opportunity. And I'm sorry I can't think of his name right now, but I just, I thought that was so awesome. The story I want to share was about a cat. This cat, I didn't even know. This brother, I didn't know. When I came back to Connecticut years ago, I had a couple of jobs, so I landed through the job I have now. One was working for a newspaper, and I was doing sales. And I remember going to the business that had this car retailing business, and he would install at that radio stuff in the nature. And, him and I was talking and he wasn't really in the ad, but I needed to get a radio installed. He said, man, we need some work. Come on back. So I came back one night after working, after five, and brought my car and get it done. He fixed it. And we just started talking. And we just started talking. And I said, man, I did some time for before I did this, he said, did some time for some drugs. He said, the good thing about it, I was similar inside while I was in. He said, you know, I was able to basically open this up. He said, I'm going to tell you this, I'm not going back anymore. He said, I'm just not. He said, I realized when I was in there, it's not the thing we're going to be doing. He said, I'm not going to go back, and I'm just going to make sure I keep myself out. And I was happy to hear, you know, I encouraged him in my words, you know, to continue on that mindset and continue on. And ironically, man, throughout the years, I ran into this cat from time to time, would see him, and I can honestly tell you, he's never went back. He took that business, launched another one, and then he started selling automobiles. He started selling solar panels. He just, you name it, he took the selling part of his life and just expanded upon it. Got married a few years ago, and every time I see him, my heart smiles because he was one that was able to say, "Hey, I'm not doing it no more." I was one to make sure that he stayed away from it. And I was happy to hear, but out there like that, man, there's so many that we basically should take a light and shine on because a lot of times we don't think of them. We think of the ones that we see out there, basically. And we spend time talking about them. It's interesting because I thought about this when I was putting this together because also when I came back to Connecticut, they were looking for correctional officers. And I knew a few people that was doing it. I was like, man, we can get you in or whatever. You know, that's not a job I could see myself doing. Excuse me. For me, I could not go to work 5-6 days a week to see men locked up. I just couldn't do it, bro. I could not basically come in and watch me locked up and envision that for 8-10 hours a day. I mean, that was just the mindset that I had to me. That was like slavery right there. Like I'm on a plantation, and it's like, how am I going to basically, you know, get them to do and react and do things? So I couldn't find myself applying for the job. And I knew at the time, and it probably still is, if you would, you know, you got hired, you worked 20 years and retired. And that was kind of the little vision, too. After 20 years, you could try and move on for retirement. So I'm going to come back, Mr. Charles. If just imagine, I don't know if you ever thought about it, but imagine yourself, if you can, being a correction officer and the thoughts that may go through your head, sir.
Nah, bro. Nope. Couldn't do it. Could not do it. I have a younger cousin that is a corrections officer in our the county system at home. And we talked about him doing it and him taking on that position. And he was pretty adamant about it, how he felt about it. And we had the discussion before he took it. I told him it was a very hard job and to make sure he was okay, not going to just see it as a paycheck because it's going to be a lot more difficult than he probably would imagine. But he assured me that he was ready because he thought about being a police officer and things of that nature. And I said, okay, before. But, no, I couldn't do it because of the fact that, and I don't go off of just TV, but what I've understood from other people, just the climate, man. I mean, there is no good climate. I mean, you can try to say, I'm going to treat people with dignity or whatever, but these are people that have been through hell in a handbasket, and most everybody deserves a fair shake. But you have to deal with all kind of personalities. My cousin was telling me that you just have to deal with personalities. You got to deal with the kind game and even some physical issues that if you slip, that can be very dangerous for you. So while I applaud those that can do it, I know someone else, too, that have been – somebody I know has been doing it for 27 years. I applaud those that can go in every day and try to make a difference in such a very difficult climate. But I know me. And it's probably for best for everybody that I don't. The same way with me being a teacher, bro, in the high schools, in the elementary school, in the school system right now, because my tolerance for certain things just won't go well. And unfortunately, when you're in that position, you have to tolerate a lot of things, and you always have to sometimes check your ego at the door. So unfortunately, you got to know when something don't work for you, and that wasn't my calling. So, no, I couldn't do that.
Yeah, I knew a few women that did it, man, and made it through. Actually, one, that made it through. Ironically, she worked in New Jersey, and she did so well at it to where she would not take vacation time, the crew time, to where she can basically get paid for not working. And the last 3 years, or for 20 years, she went back to school and was basically going to school full-time, not working as a correction officer, and getting paid to go to school. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, they might even pick up the school tab also. But I just couldn't see myself on a daily basis handling that. But, yeah, I applaud those that do. It's something to think about, man, because you see yourself basically, I know it's a far stretch from what you do now, but could you see yourself basically being a correctional officer?
Personally, no. I remember having a conversation with Doc, and he saw one of the guys we played football with who was a correctional officer. And Doc described it as it was hard on the both of them because, you know, these are our boys, you know. And he said he had to console the guy who was our correctional officer because he was like, he was so sad to see him in prison like that. And, you know, imagine a prisoner consoling the prison guard, saying, you know, man, it's all right, man. It's okay. It's cool. You know, I put myself in this position. You know, don't worry about it. And it was really kind of when I heard it, I didn't really think about it that way because I have a couple of friends I used to go to high school with who are correctional officers. And, you know, you have to have a kind of a tough, thick skin to be that. And you dehumanize folks. And I'll give you an example of a place I did work, and I worked real shortly with. There's two places I worked with. There's a place called the Sexual Foundation here that works with ex-offenders, and there's a place called Safe Haven here. And when I would work with the clients there, man, at first they give you a hard time because they're used to being treated like they're not human. But once they get to know you and you start working with them, I can't tell you how many times I've talked to men and women who say, yo, you're not like the regular staff. And they're like, well, what do you mean? It's like, you treat us like we matter. You treat us like, you know, we're human beings and you treat us with respect. And he said, that's why you get a lot of respect from a lot of the folks in here. And these are at both places, two separate places, two separate staffs. And you can see the mentality of the staff. They treat the clients there, they treat the folks that are locked up there, or that they feel that they have upper hand on. And I'll just be very, very blunt. They treat them like shit. They treat them like they're never going to forgive them for whatever they did and that they are beneath them. And their attitude, the way they talk to them, the way they interact with them is almost like it's dehumanizing. And here are people who are working hard, you know, for the most part, trying to, you know, correct their mistakes. They're trying to right the wrong, and they're trying to get themselves and then they have some character flaws that they need to work on. But to be treated like that, I never could condone that. So both places I left very, very abruptly because it's like, if I'm the only one treating folks, you know, as human beings, then what the hell am I doing here with these folks? And I didn't want that to get on me as far as I take on that attitude of treating folks that are housed there or that are in residentials or can't leave, don't have the ability to leave or locked down. I didn't want to be in that situation. Same thing I did with the federal prison, going in there, teaching parenting classes in the federal prison. You see the mentality of the folks, and then you go in there, they're expecting the same mentality coming from you, and you don't give them that, and the energy changes with them. And so they look forward to seeing you. They look forward to hearing from you. They look forward to working with you. They're more cooperative. You know, you're reaching them as a human being, saying, I see the situation you're in. Let me give you some things that can get you out of this situation. Let me give you some things to think about as far as your family on the outside and what they need from you right now and all that other stuff. And it's just a mentality that it never settled well with me, and it's against the grain of who I am as a person. So, no, I couldn't see myself doing that.
Yeah, that's a tough gig, bro. It really is. I see both sides of the coin there because I think in a sense the people that are probably in that way, they're afraid to if they don't, then like Mr. Charles says, some things might come their way. And they're kind of doing it in a sense out of fear, not saying it's right, but and they might have been told to handle people that way, which is, here again, makes it a real tough situation. I wanted to spend a little time thinking of approaching this, because I'm going to ask this for a reason, in a sense, because you look at early on, I'm going to take you both back to your early days of grammar school, and we, you know, even in the grammar school, there were some of us that just always cut up, whatever reason, man, we just cut up. We really didn't in school pay attention. We didn't focus. And it could have been because our upbringing or whatever, but we were all around people, and I know I were, when we were around people in school that we just kind of knew there was, they weren't taking this serious. They wasn't taking their education serious, and they were kind of basically, you know, at that point going on a different path. So with that being said, I'm going to come to you with this, Mr. DeMaurice, but sometimes, you know, early on, you know, young black boys, you know, when it comes to school education, could that be a precursor when they're not really locked in, they're not engaged, they're not really feeling education, they're not applying themselves, their parents aren't really making sure that they go to school and give of themselves to the education, could that be a precursor that maybe start to set the stage as they age to maybe lend them to selling drugs, true or false?
Yeah, definitely, man, definitely, because you know, you're around your peers, you see, and you're involved in a lot of things. I was part of a project here where the statistics were that between the grades of eighth grade and ninth grade, once a kid gets into ninth grade, the school system kind of changes a little bit, because now you're not kind of forced in growing with the pack, going to the same classes, being with the same students. Now you got a schedule where you have to kind of fend for yourself. And there was no transition period to doing that. So I think the stat, if I can remember correctly, was that between the ninth grade and whether it's sophomore and junior year, from the freshman class, it is a 40% dropout rate. That's almost 50% because they can't make the adjustment. And that sets the stage for them dropping out of school, not coming back to school, not going for a GED. And I know here in Illinois, as well as other states, is the first day of attendance of every school year, is they do it for a number of reasons. One, they do it to see how much funding the schools are going to get. So that's why people are pushing kids to go on the first day of school, because that's how they count the numbers. And the other thing is a phenomenon that they call the school-to-prison pipeline. And you can look it up. And researchers have been doing this for years, that the chances of those kids that drop out, they count jail cells, how many jail cells they're going to need by the end of those 4 years, because the likelihood of them getting jobs that are legal as opposed to illegal trying to take care of themselves, there's going to be a lower rate of folks getting, you know, legitimate jobs that can sustain themselves, and more likely that they're going to be getting illegal jobs, whether it's prostitution, whether it's drugs, whether it's theft, all this other stuff. So there is a phenomenon out there that they studied, social scientists have studied, and they have correlated that once these kids don't make it to school, that we're going to need the same percentage of jail cells to house them in, which boosts up industries in the prisons to put their businesses in prisons to make money without paying workers fair wages or fringe benefits or health care, all this other stuff. So it's kind of like these folks have already got this in mind that, okay, you're not going to go to school. Likelihood, you're going to be in life of crime. You're going to get caught. You're going to be working for me for 19 cents an hour.
I see, bro. Even I've heard it before, but to hear it again, it's chilling and it's deep. Because in reality, it is reality. And I, as you was talking, I thought back to my grammar school and the cats I kind of went to grammar school with. And I can honestly say, bro, due to selling drugs and that lifestyle, a good proportion of them are no longer living.
Mm-hmm.
No longer living. And some of the cats that I went to school with, that cut up, they didn't take it serious, that it was, you know, it was a joke. And as I age and they age, I seen the direction they went. And, yeah, man, a lot of them I remember one, man. I'll say this real quick, Mr. Charles, while I come to you. There was one cat that I grew up with, and I remember him and I used to, you know, fight for the most part, off and on. We just battle. And it almost seemed like we just fought because we just wanted to. it just what it was.
It's always one.
Yeah, it's always one, brother. Just, you know. And sometimes after we fight, he would just laugh. He just liked to fight.
Yeah.
It just, you know, it was what it was. And I remember as we came and I left high school and shortly after, I heard he went down south to Carolinas and basically doing the same thing he was doing up here, man. And he chose a cat to fight. That's what I understand. He fought him the first time. And he kind of came back and did the same thing the second time. Cat pulled a gun out and blew him away. Blew him away. So you think about his childhood antics led him to getting his life taken. And, I mean, that's how deep that is sometimes, bro. It's just amazing. I want to come back to some things you said, but I want to bring Mr. Charles in on this really, because early education, I'm amazed when parents, you know, not only with black boys, but just with black kids in general, don't really understand how early and how precious that is to setting the foundation for your child and for children. But for black males in general, because we're speaking about them this evening, Mr. Charles, you know, really when you think about those early days of going to school, eating your peanut butter and jelly sandwich, drinking your chocolate milk, having your Jell-O, all those years, those days, man, if you're not tuned in, is it setting the precursor for when you get older, maybe opening a door for you to want to sell drugs, true or false, sir?
It could be. I say yes, it could be. And the reasoning behind it, though, is oftentimes if a child is quiet, the educators, unfortunately, they maybe sometimes may not be clued in to that a kid is not comprehending anything. So I know back in the day there was a time where as long as you weren't doing anything and you weren't bothering anybody, then the teacher would leave you alone. And I'm sure that happens now too. But they would leave you alone, and sometimes somebody asks you to read something or engage, then you don't, unless you engage with a kid, you don't really know whether or not they comprehend or you are after they take a test. But it's tough, man. Like I said, I was, you know, I didn't go that route, but I know how difficult it was for me in school because I didn't know how to study. I wasn't stupid. Again, I just didn't know how to study. And nobody ever took the time to teach me how to study past just studying on your own. Nobody took me aside and said, here's what you got to do when you're in high school. This is how you study. Again, I didn't learn how to study until I got to high school. I mean, to college. But, yeah, it can be because at that point as a young person, particularly a young African-American man, you're looking at yourself like, damn, man, I'm trying, but this S is not working. And then you get defeated, and you're like, well, hell, if I can't go to school, then I got to do what I got to do sometimes to make money. And you just don't want to be a lug on a log. And that's not to rationalize it, but you don't want to be somebody that, you know, your parents or mom or grandmom or somebody got to take care of. So you want to make your own. So a lot of young men turn to doing other things. But it starts with, I think, really finding out what's going on. We have a lot at our disposal now. But, hell, when you think about it, I can tell you this. How many of these kids, including myself, might have been somewhat low-key dyslexic, bro. And nobody knew. We didn't know that certain kids learn differently. You got to teach them differently. It was one speed. And if you didn't catch on the speed, you got put in that class nobody wants to be put in, the slow learners. So, I mean, you say, well, we look at the certain things, but damn. So, and then some people are just late bloomers. I could go on forever on that, but I'll leave that right there.
No, good point. But very good point. Which is interesting because you know, like you said, but your kid is quiet. A lot of times they will kind of just basically leave that kid to basically just be that, and they may not kind of clue in to what's going on there. What's sad about that, and I, you know, even with that being said, I see what's kind of sad about that is because if you don't really kind of harness in and prepare the kids or young kids or young black males early in the educational point to set the foundation, what tends to happen in a lot of cases is that as they start to age and come of life, like you said, Mr. DeVries, they get to a certain point where now what can I do? Because we all know life comes to you with certain expectations. You must do this to have that. You must do this to have a roof over your head. And you must, in a proper way, do it. And if you're not prepared, you know, to do it in a proper way, here comes the frustration. Because in a sense, you haven't been nurtured, you haven't been molded, or allow yourself to be molded to basically take on the roles and expectations to handle life. So when that's dropped in front of you, in a sense, and for the most part, you're at a stage in life where, okay, you want to eat what they're eating, you want to wear what they're wearing, you want to drive what they're driving, how am I going to do this? How am I going to make this happen? And, you know, especially for a young male, you know, at the same time when you're young, you want to attract women. And there's a certain brand of women out there that are attractive to what if you do X, Y, Z. You know, because I'm pretty sure we all basically attract the opposite sex in one form or another. We did something. It could be, I'm not stupid, what it was. I don't care if it was rolling your pants leg up. Something you did that you figure going to set you apart to track her, you know, track some of them. So with that being said, I'm coming back to you, Mr. Charles, because here's where I think it kind of happens, and I understand the kid might be, you know, not participating. And I'm only banging this point because I really want to kind of make a point in the sense that this is how deep really early education is. From kindergarten up, man, this is how deep it is because once a kid gets, in my opinion, once a kid gets to a certain point, I missed the Dean Reese said 8th or 9th grade, and it's not instilled, chances are it won't be instilled. As you're going back and making up for that and trying to instill it, it's not. But that doesn't mean life doesn't come with expectations because you didn't get it back then. It doesn't mean life rolled over and go, you know what, hey, I'll give you this anyway. No, life, the role of life, especially for a male, role of life still brings you those expectations and expect you to fulfill them. So when those expectations and those roles of expectations hit you in the face and you don't have that foundation and the frustration kicks in, does that make it real easy to say, you know what, I'm just going to do this? That's a question for you.
Is that for me? I'm sorry.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That, you said that's for me or DeMaurice?
No, that's for you, Mr. Charles. I'm sorry. That's the question for you, sir.
Okay. I think yes, it makes it very difficult because of the factors that, like you said, we all like things. We have certain things that we enjoy, and you see other people doing things. Well, you're coming back to the education part as well, too. So you see other people receiving accolades or being able to do things. And then, of course, the average kid wants that, too. You know, I remember, I make this personal very quickly, I remember being a junior and senior in high school, particularly a senior, and kids talking about going to college. And I was excited because I wanted to go to college. And my counselor told me, you need to go to trade school. I was like, damn, for real? But it was real.
Wow.
That's all he knew. Oh, yeah, that's what he told me. He said, looking at your transcripts and your grades, bruh, yeah, you might as well get ready for a trade school. He said, I'm just trying to be nice, trying to help you. Okay, you help me. Basically, I had no shot in hell going to college, bruh. Because according to my transcript, I wasn't college too. And I get that. I get it. But I was thinking, well, why are they better than me? You know, I still have the rest of my life to live, but, you know, no disrespect to the service or anything, but that's what's supposed to be my plight. So I get it. But if you don't have that in you or nobody tells you, then most people quit and give up. Thank God my father was like, I don't give a damn what they say. You going to college. You just flunk out and come on home, but you know, damn stuff. You know what I'm saying? Because I was like everybody else. Yeah, I don't belong there. You know, I'm going to try it. You know, work out. I just want to come home and sell dope or whatever. I'll figure this shit out. Because my dad had told me certain things I couldn't do because he'd already experienced those. But I was like, nah, I don't belong here. But like I said, thank God my father had somebody. I had somebody like my dad. Other people don't have that. So therefore, they give up and they say, hell, it ain't for me. I'm going to try something different.
I remember a few years ago, my son's high school, and the guidance conference held like a college thing to come in and learn about scholarships and stuff for colleges. So my son and I attend, and we come in. There's really not that many people there. We're sitting around, and I'm going to say it might have been 8, roughly. So one of the guidance counselors, a lady, started talking, and I noticed she kept talking about state and community colleges. And I'm sitting there thinking, why is she beating state university and just beating community colleges like that's all there is? And then it hit me that a lot of these kids, what she see on a daily basis, their grades would be lucky if they got community colleges. And I'm looking around again. I'm serious. You're looking at several hundred kids in this class. And in this room that we're in, nice-sized room, there's 8. And that's including the adults with the kids. 8 of us there. And that's disheartening to see, bro. And I'm not saying every kid has to go to college, but what are these kids doing in high school? What are their parents having them doing in high school? To where your grades would basically, you know, only get you to go X, Y, Z. So at first I'm like, you know, what the heck she's talking about? And then I start to put it all together and understand it. That, yeah. And, you know, we kind of, you know, I love what your father said to me, Mr. Charles. You're going, you know, you don't care. You're going to college, bro. And that's that mentality that's missing today. Because a lot of times these parents are allowing kids to basically, as Mrs. DeMarie said earlier, drop out of school. Nothing burns me up more than I see a grown man at his parents' house, 19, 20 years old, not working, but standing outside smoking weed. Current day times, bro. What the hell is going on with that? You tell me. You have no employment at all. None. Done slept all night. It's 1 o'clock in the afternoon. The best you could do is stand your black ass outside and smoke a joint. And your mom and daddy's okay with that. Mr. DeMarie, I'm going to bring the same question to you, sir. In a sense where life, in a sense where if you don't get that foundation early, man, you don't get that education, you don't get that boost, you don't get that level. As you start to progress in life, the roles in life does not basically change or bend for men, especially for black men. It comes with expectations. We are to do X, Y, Z. We are to provide. We are to do this. And when you can't do those things, does it basically put you in the steering behind the steering wheel to sell drugs?
Yeah, I mean, it does. It could lead you in that direction. I'm going to take a different turn on this. This is why I love HBCU so much, is because they took that in consideration when you stepped on that campus that you didn't have that foundation. So they met you where you were. So I know Mr. Childs remembers this. They've had the writing lab. The reading lab, they would test you, figure out where you were. And, okay, we're going to boost you up. I don't care where you start. You can have a 7th grade, 8th grade level. By the time you leave here, if you're willing to work, you're going to be on that level where you're prepared to go out there and compete. But they didn't throw away students that, you know, other universities would say, well, you're reading on this level, you don't match up. And so I think, you know, if we're going to take an approach to, you know, really kind of relate to especially folks that look like us, to give them that second chance or that third or fourth chance to get into school, realizing that they didn't get the foundation, because a lot of us don't, man. A lot of us don't get that foundation in school, man. We got to go above and beyond to get that foundation, bro. And there aren't too many people that will help you out doing that. And so I got students that have left two-year programs in community college and went through Chicago Public Schools, and they're juniors, and they realize that, okay, I don't have everything I need, and then it's a fast dash for 2 years to get them up to speed so they feel confident, especially our people of color, because they do a disservice. I think education does a disservice to people of color, and they don't give us what we need to do. And I think it's by design, man, to survive in this society. So that's why I love HBCUs, because on every campus I've talked to different people who go to HBCUs. They meet students where they are. They know that folks are coming out of Detroit and Chicago and New York, and they're not prepared yet. They're coming out of high school programs that did not really prepare them for college. And they get you there and they go, you know what? You're not there yet, but we're going to work with you. As long as you're willing to work, we're going to work with you and get you where you need to be by the time you get out of this school. And I think that more of us, as far as not even in the academic realm, but in the workplace, things of that sort, we need to realize that some of these kids get railroaded in education. Never forget this. I'll tell this story and I'll get off it. I was teaching an intro to African American class, and I teach it from time to time. And I remember this young sister. She was so fascinated with the class, 16-week class. She was so fascinated. I mean, she was dialed in. And you could tell she came from the inner city schools, the way she would kind of, you know, talk and she would ask questions. And, you know, I was always on her about her papers. Here's what you did to do to improve, all this other stuff. And she told me, she came to me with tears in her eyes at the end of the class. And I thought it was tears because she thought she was going to fail the class or something like that. And, you know, I was prepared to say, no, you've done really good. She was like, I want to thank you. She said, because I learned in 16 weeks about my people more than I did in 12 years of high school, about Africans, my people, my history. She said, they don't teach any of this stuff in the school. She said, if I would have got this, she said, I'd have been a much better student. Because she said, I was a little, the reason why I wanted to take the class is because I didn't know much about it. And she said, but the things you were teaching me boosted up my self-esteem, made me proud of my history and where I came from. A lot of these kids ain't getting that, man, about the true history. History didn't start in slavery. That's what the schools, they teach you. They teach you about oppression, how your group was oppressed. And people shun away from that. They don't want to learn about that. But when I start going into Mensa Musa and all the different dynasties in Africa and all this other stuff, and it was like, she was like, no, they don't teach this stuff. And I'm like, sister, there's a reason why they don't teach this stuff, because if you have this stuff, nothing can be withheld from you. And I was able to see her from time to time. She'd give me a big old hug. She was like, this is my professor right here. I don't care what class I'm taking. This is my professor right here. And she would brag to all her friends, you need to take his class, because he's going to give you a history lesson and stuff you ain't heard before. But if we instill that in our kids, man, nothing will be withheld from them. And I think that's by design, man. You don't tell people about their true history, that it's not about being enslaved and being less than and all that other stuff. That's why they're fighting this telling true history in school now, because they had told lies over the years. But now they got to face up to those lies, all those lies they told in history class, and excluding everybody. That's why they're fighting it, because now if they know the truth, oh, shit, they're coming. Coming from there.
Can I add something to that?
About
real
time,
quick,
bro. Oh, please do. Please do, my brother. Please do.
Let me just say this, man. D. Maurice, Jane Ball is smiling down on you right now, boy. Real talk. Real tough. I never told you before just what you said, that passion goes 100. It goes a long way. And as a kid that really didn't think they belonged, and at Wilberforce, what he said is so true, and so many other historically black colleges, when you feel like somebody's not throwing you away, man, you know, a lot of people probably take that for granted, don't know what you're talking about. But if you're in a position where you feel vulnerable, you know, don't feel like you're the smartest person in the world, and somebody doesn't just throw you away because you don't have, as Lee Maurice mentioned, you don't have that, you're not at that level yet to compete. But instead of throwing you away, they give you an opportunity. It changes your mindset, like you said. You feel like, man, I have a chance. So much is going on because oftentimes when you're in a position like this, not just your dreams of your future, your future are riding on you, but oftentimes your own family legacies, the legacy of your family is riding on you because you're the first one to go to college. All this pressure. And you're like, man, I don't even belong up in this mother. You know what I'm saying? I'm selling dope, whatever. I'm getting high to pass classes. No, that's my story. I ain't telling you. Give a week, no. No. That's why I couldn't mess with Dima Reese early on, because he was a student. Dima Reese was, that's why I teased you, because because he know he was a student. I was, you know, shit, they was like, we hope we make it. You know what I'm saying? That was my shot. Real talk, man. But to have somebody tell you, you can make it. You know, we talk about Mrs. Jane Ball who passed away. I told you, she fucked me, man, in a class. I was like, damn, was I that bad? You just don't fuck me. And she's like, no, I have to show you something. And the lesson was invaluable. But the whole point of it is, getting back to that point, is just saying, when somebody believes in you and they really tell you, despite what you knew before, what you lack, we're going to take time to give you the tools you need. It's something that it will make you cry, bro. Like you said about that sister, learning who she was, where she comes from, and knowing that despite what you missed or what you're lacking, you have a chance. That is powerful. So to hear Dean Marie still saying that, I'm ready. I'm going to have to call some people. We send you back to the HBCU, boy. That's what you know. I don't know which one it is yet. But damn it, if I had to come up with some coin, I got a few wealthy friends, I'm going to get y'all. And I know, disrespect to your current employer, but I'm going to get y'all. We need you on campus, bro. I ain't mad at the other folks, but we need you somewhere on HBCU putting it down. And I'd be great. I'd be glad to be a guest speaker. So we'll talk about that offline, bro. I'm sorry, bro. He got me right there. He got me emotional now. Can you talk about me, motherfucker? You know what
I'm saying? Oh, you know, gentlemen, I had a couple of more things to go with this. I'm gonna leave that there because I think that tops this where it needs to be. It just does, man. And I'll go back to what I said earlier about shifting the atmosphere. We change the approach how we look at things and how we deal with things, and not necessarily throwing people away. Just because they may be doing something that we're not proud of, that we're not happy, we're going to take it to prayer to get them to do what they need, should be doing, allow God to handle that. Because I can't say over the years I've really prayed for folks that's doing that to change things and be better. And by not doing so and not putting that faith there, I'm basically, in a sense, committing to the point where let them just do what they're going to do. So that just happens. But as we know, prayer can change anything. So I know, we change and shift our atmosphere to look at it differently, view them differently, and pray them back to where they come back to the center, I think we'll be surprised, greatly surprised. So we're going to take a break. And we did our prayer earlier. From time to time, gentlemen, we'll do that again. Man, we'll take 30 seconds out and pray for them, because prayer has to be consistent. It has to be strong. And it has to kind of always be there. So we're never going to be afraid to do it. We'll do it more, and we'll do it often right here on When Black Men Talk. It's Mr. Charles, Mr. DeMaurice, myself, Mark Elliott. We'll take a little break. We'll come back. We'll see if these gentlemen have questions for us.
One, two, three.
Dexter, come to you first for your question for this evening, sir.
It's kind of a question and comment about the Olympics. I think they're wrapping it up now. I didn't watch a number of the events. I'm just not into it. But something that really kind of made me feel a certain kind of way, man, is that, I'll start off by saying this. I appreciate the athletes who work hard to go to the Olympics and to compete in the various events that they compete in. I'm taking nothing away from them, their accomplishments, things that they did and they're doing. Shout out to Allison Felix, who really been putting it down for a long time. I kind of felt a certain kind of way when I see, especially black athletes, they win and then they drape themselves with the American flag, and it kind of bothers me because they're embracing a flag in a country that still won't embrace them, and it kind of shined more in this day and age than any other time. I remember I used to get excited about the Olympics, whether it was the winter or the Summer Olympics. I used to get excited, and we didn't have what we had now, where we can go to different venues and watch it live and all this other stuff, sports that we haven't even seen before. We used to just watch it, whatever channel was on, for as long as it was on when we were kids. But now they have all this access to all these different games, and it's not really swaying me to watch. I'm not really interested. But every time I saw, the American black athletes drape themselves in the flag, it just kind of turned me off in a way, thinking that they're embracing a country that's not going to embrace them when they get back. They'll have the hoopla, fanfare, winning a gold medal. But I always get the image of Muhammad Ali in a movie, and I don't know if it's true or not, throwing away or losing his medal. And it didn't mean much to him after he got back in the country after winning the 1960 gold medal for boxing, and how he was treated once he got back in his country. So I want to just throw that out there. How do you feel about the Olympics and all the sports and events?
I remember saying a few weeks ago when all this started that, I didn't think we as people should be in part of the Olympics. Now, I don't necessarily blame anyone. And for going and doing so, but I think I can relate to what you're saying when you see him drape with the flag, because they want to believe that America is different than what it is, bro. And what happens a lot of times with black athletes, I'm speaking of, you get used to the white adulation, and you start to think, because they're cheering and they're doing this, that they must just love me. They love what you're doing. And they get caught up in that. So for a lot of these folks that's trained and they did that, and they know that Americans are back home watching, for them it's a moment to shine. And they, and I'm not going to say they're trying to win over white people, but they want that adulation. And they want the endorsements money too. Don't get me wrong. Because as you two made it clear that a lot of them go just for money. That's why I understand when the basketball player from the L.A. Sparks, the lady, I can't think of her name right now, was so upset and mad when they didn't pick her to go. And I would think at any time right now in this country, you would basically shun the Olympics. I mean, I would have thought that especially black basketball players, I mean, if you're already making millions, Kevin Durant, this one, that one, all of them, man, they're over there cheesing, and far as I'm concerned, gooning it up. They just are. But what? What are you proving? What are you really proving? They won a gold medal, so what? You've been playing basketball all your life. What are you proving? When you know what's going on back here. So these are the cats to me, man. I will look at them based on what you're saying. I look at them more harsher than the other folks, man, because some of them, that's all they know. They've trained this their entire lives to get there. But to me, if I'm a professional athlete, such as a basketball player, I'm not going. I'm going to tell you why I'm not going to go. And none of them done that, bro. Because at the end of the day, again, due to the white adulation that they seek, they believe, because of that, outside of being black, they're outside. They're pulled outside. We might still be inside of being black, but they're pulled outside based on the fact that they can dribble a basketball. When they look in the stands, that's all they see. I remember Lil Wayne, his dumbass, said this. He said that, you know, when I perform, all I see is white people in the audience. So it's somewhat racism. Think about that, bro. He said, and he said this a couple of years ago. When I perform, all I see is white people in the stands. So how could racism exist? With that, I'll slide over to you, Mr. Jones.
Wow. But every time we talk about this, my heart is torn in two different directions. Because I understand exactly the feeling and about the country and whatnot. But I also think about certain athletes, particularly like the track athletes, because for the often for them, the way that they make their money is like Simone Biles and other people. What is the Allison Felix? Those are the people when they go to the Olympics. That's how they get the endorsement money. That's how they live well, because the other events during the time that they are athletes doesn't really pay the bills. This is when they are. This is the time they are the stars. And as crazy it may sound and as jilted and them being pimped or used, people may say that too, it's hard for me to kind of come down on those particular track athletes because this is how they make their money. And to think, I just see it different ways. I think that for all that we say and everybody is entitled to their opinion, but to say I wouldn't participate, I mean, I get that too, particularly with the millionaire athletes and Kevin Durant or whatever, and they might be doing it for their brand, and that's their right to do so if they want to. But for so many others, that's how they make their big dollars. And to me, despite the country doing what it's doing, I think it's bigger than that for me, for some of these athletes. And I say that because of the fact that we are clearly aware of the history of this country and the way it's treated people of color, particularly African Americans. But on the strength of that, I also know that I think you don't, they don't have to, but it sends a message. It has been sending a message for years when we are able to do what we do, even from an athletic standpoint, about the way that we make a difference in this damn country. And I say that with all, in all honesty, I think about Jesse Owens. We know what was going on over here. I could easily see people saying, I'm not participating because of the way they treat us. We talk about the war, the veterans, you talk about that all day long. But the fact, imagine if Jesse Owens did not go to Germany and destroy the myth that the Germans had. Think about that man going and looking at the so-called one that some people call the one of the ultimate oppressors, and look him in his eye as you destroy team, everything he's talking about on the main stage. In athletics, that's the one thing they couldn't stop. I think about Muhammad Ali, you mentioned that too. I think he got a raw deal because of the fact that he's feeling somewhere about the draft too. But just saying that if we didn't have the stage for even though they were persecuted, Tommy Smith and John Carlos, if they didn't have a stage, then what? I guess my point of it is, even though a lot of them don't do it, I still see the athletic-based opportunity for these individuals to make a stand despite what the country's doing. That's just me, and I might be – that's just my opinion on certain ones. Other ones, it's all about the cash. I get that, but I think there are certain individuals that are making marks. Like, I was going to bring it up, but I'll bring it up later another time, maybe on the sports show. But to watch the women's 4x400-meter relay, I almost start crying. Because even though I had to see it on a delay, that's another thing. You couldn't watch the damn thing because it wasn't ever on. You don't know what channel you're watching, but that's another story. But to watch these women, the best of the best, participate, you think about that from the standpoint of Felix was a 400-meter person that was a sprinter that was amazing. Then you take two 400-meter hurdlers that were good champions, and you take an 800-meter champion. Put them all together. To me, that's what sports is about. And they blew away the competition. That's what it's about. More to me, it's larger than this country that have been trying to hold us back for forever. But again, we continue. I know it's a little long, but and it's also deeper than this that we talk about. But we have still continued to strive and show the world, despite the BS that's going on, we are gems. We're golden. We're talented, and this is who we are. And there's nothing you can do to stop it.
You know what's interesting, man? I'll say this before I come to Mr. DeReese. And when Mr. Charles was talking, I was just thinking about this. Because here's one thing that I'll say to kind of piggyback on what I said earlier about the professional basketball players, in a sense. Whenever socially you want to make an impact or have something done, you must be willing to sacrifice. You must be willing to sacrifice. And that, to me, is what the current-day athlete, not only, and a non-athlete, we aren't built that way anymore, bro. Some of us. Let's say majority. Because you think about the Montgomery bus strike that went on, or boycott that went on years ago. That was a sacrifice. These people walk miles in the heat to basically not ride a bus that didn't treat them like humans. So it's hard in current day time when a black man or a black woman is making millions of dollars, millions, and you say to them or someone says to them, hey, sacrifice some to make a point, make a stance. I'm sacrificing what? For who? That's what it comes down to, bro. They don't understand that. And I get it for the ones that, you know, here again, that train hard to go there. But you look at the NBA basketball team, just look at them. What are they going to sacrifice? Name me an NBA player. Hell, name me a football player outside of Colin Kaepernick that was willing to sacrifice anything for their people. Your response to your question or your statement, Mr. DeMarie.
Yeah, and I understand what Mr. Charles was saying about being torn, because I think we're all torn with this, because I love track and field. I love watching that. I didn't get to see boxing, and Americans didn't really show anything in boxing this year. The folks from Cuba, those guys and women can really go. But it does tear you apart to see that, you know, it's not in everybody to be that active. And maybe some of the things that when they come back here will help them see that, okay, yeah, I had this shining moment, but there's still problems here where people will look like me. And maybe it's just not in them to kind of go out there and do what Jesse Owens did and what other, athletes did to say, you know, there's a problem at home. Although I'm competing on this stage, that we need to make the world aware of this. And you even have the Olympic committee, shun that. You know, don't do no protests, all that other stuff. And how dare you? How dare you try to tell me what to do and how to protest and all that other stuff if I want to make a statement? So it is that kind of torn thing where you see your people and you want to root for them and you want them to be successful, but then you see that flag, and I see everything that flag represents, and it ain't always good when it comes to me and the people who look like me. So it kind of sends a cringe to me when I see, you know, you drape yourself in an American flag, knowing when you come home, or maybe you haven't figured out when you come home, that everybody don't love you like that. They wanted to see you fail. They wanted to see you kind of embarrass yourself on the world stage because they don't have no love for you, and they're not going to embrace you like you're trying to embrace this flag in this country.
Yeah. Mr. Charles, if you have another question for us, sir, we're happy to take it.
Sure. My question is, in this regards to the details that you sent in regards to the Operation New Optic and the arrest made in the 35-member drug ring, were you guys able to pay attention to some of the sentencing and the amount of money and the things that they took off the street, off these individuals? I was really quite puzzled by the fact that with all of the things that supposedly went down and what they had taken these gentlemen from these men in regards to the amount of the money, the amount of drugs, and to have an open sentence for some of them from 5 to 40 years. Somebody explained to me what the hell does 5 to 40 mean. And I talked to somebody that has an understanding of this, and I want to try to get an understanding here. What does that mean, 5 to 40 years? That is possibility of our sentencing.
I think. I mean, my quick, thought to that is that I think they're basically saying you could do many of 5, but you could do a max of 40, and they're kind of being vague about it based on how you probably may handle yourself in jail or in prison or stuff of that nature. But I think and I was going to, have this as a question earlier, man. I think what black people need to realize is this, even with gentrification, they're tired of us, bro. They are tired of us kind of being in the way with the crime and all that stuff. And I'm not saying we don't want to do crime. They want to move forward and have things a certain way. So if they can put a sentence over your head where they can go back and it varies like a credit card finance interest rate, well, that's what they're doing. So, no, they're not going to say to you no more, hey, here's 5 years because you did X, Y, Z. No, we're going to get between 5 and 40, and we'll move the ruler to where we want to move because we don't want you out here anymore. No, we want to be able to come into your town, eat, shop, spend money, and come out of your town and feel safe. Your response, Mr. DeMaris.
Yeah, I think it's a way to move the goalposts, like you said. It's a range on how you really kind of adjust to prison life, and if you do anything else, it can increase, or other charges that come after that. So it's a way to kind of safeguard, how long we can keep you here based on your behavior. Man, this is I fight the guys all the time and women too, and this is this game has been set up and rigged because these prisons are making money. They're making money, and they become industry. I asked this as a student a few weeks ago. How many of you know who – I know you see office equipment and different offices and all that stuff. How many of you know of anybody who works and builds office equipment? And they're like, no. I said, it's built in prison. Some of the food that you eat, whole food, you go in there getting that healthy food and you're eating well. Some of the stuff is being grown in prison. You call customer service. You may be talking to a prisoner. They're not going to identify as a prisoner, but you may be talking to a prisoner. So all these jobs and all this stuff going, it's a billion-dollar operation, and it's set on the backs of folks. When slavery was abolished, the prison rates went up. It was almost like America after slavery and getting all that free labor, they didn't have a contingency plan on what we're going to do with these slaves who are out and they want to make money and they want to live. It should have just said, okay, you're finished. So we're going to put you back on ship. We're going to send you back to where we got you from. Your work is done here. Maybe a little stipend going on the way. But they have no idea what they want to do with us. And so now we're kind of stuck here in this kind of binary situation where, we're in different cities. We're trying to make it. The policies and laws are against us. So they move the goalposts on us all the time. Some new rules, some new thing that we have to, you know, take in consideration to try to get free or to try to liberate ourselves. And it just seems like a no-win situation. So that's the way I look at that prison term. You could do anywhere from 5 to 40. Like, you know, tell me what I need to do. But they can change the goalposts. They're just letting you know we can change the goalposts any way we want, depending on what you have to benefit us or if we want to benefit off of you while you're in prison. Are we still on the air?
Yeah,
man, something else. Yeah, I know you a quick second, bro, but I'm assuming we're back off, man. With that being said, gremlins, I guess, are running around here tonight. Mr. Charles, your response, sir?
Yeah, the reason why I asked that question is because of the fact that when I looked at the numbers, one of the numbers that I noticed early on was the fact that they talked about that the agents seized like 4.5 kilograms of suspected cocaine, 450 grams of suspected crack cocaine. And the amount of money they received, they got was $272,000, $272,500, something to that effect. And I'm thinking about that sentence, 5 to 40. I personally knew a friend of mine that was a kingpin, and I mentioned this earlier, that was bringing in 20 kilos a month, bro, cocaine. And at that time, it was $1.3 million in the '90s. And there wasn't no way in hell that by himself that he got no 5 years. It was straight. You know what I'm saying? He was kingpin status. So when I hear 5 to 40, I'm like, is this way or some way for, not saying we should really at all say this is to glamorize this at all, but my thinking is with that in mind, how big are you? Are you trying to show people that you really are putting work in when you go 5 to 40? I don't know. Maybe it's just my experience, but I just see this as something that you guys said. They're moving the goalposts. But back in the day, it was either all or nothing usually, bro. They usually would wait till they got bigger numbers and more people before they started to really announce that it was like a major drug bust. I've seen more. People get more time, and there definitely wasn't no 5 years or at the minimum for selling prescription drugs. Anyway, that's for another day.
John, we'll put a cap on this one a little early. Appreciate you, Bill, too, doing what you always do, coming in and bringing it strong. It's interesting, man. I'm not sure how this happened, but we had a cat that basically wanted to come on, had done some time, wanted to come on this show and speak, and it's a good possibility. We come back on 2 weeks, I might have this brother come on and enlighten us. He found a way to come in and dial in, and he was listening, and he reached out to me as the show was going on. But we may have that take place and come on, because here again, man, we want to show that some are basically coming away and doing what they should be doing. Until we get together in 2 weeks, you brothers, stay strong, stay black. And if you can't stay safe, we'll do it again. It's One Black Man Talk, Mr. Dean Maurice, Mr. Charles. I'm One More Jelly.